Today is Monday, July 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Federal troops continue their crackdown in the western U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, even as officials and residents don't want them there.
Their actions are terrifying. This is beyond acceptable.
Plus, can the European Union reach a budget deal?
Make it something that fits, because the European Union can't be doing this again in a year's time if this agreement didn't work.
And the hidden toll of COVID-19 on mental health. We'll have those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump condemned protests in the western city of Portland, Oregon, and violence in so-called Democrat-run cities on Sunday. As his Republican administration moves to intervene in urban centers, he says, have lost control of anti-racism demonstrations. Federal law enforcement officers, armed with a new executive order aimed at protecting U.S. monuments, last week started cracking down on crowds gathering in Portland to protest police brutality and systemic racism. Footage from Portland on Sunday night showed a large crowd of demonstrators crowded around the federal courthouse building chanting slogans including Black Lives Matter and This is not a riot. Eventually, authorities rushed the crowd amid explosions and gas. Demonstrators could be seen running away. On Friday, dozens of women lined up to form a barrier between demonstrators and federal as well as local law enforcement officers chanting The Moms Are Here. One woman, who didn't give her name, spoke to Reuters News.
Their actions are terrifying. I mean, we as a democracy, and we need to stand up. I'm 60 years old. I probably shouldn't be here in public, but this is beyond acceptable.
That followed Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler's news conference Friday, where he criticized the president as well as the actions he's taken.
The videos, the pictures, the experiences that we're all witnessing here in Portland should be shocking to all Americans. The words and actions from President Trump and the Department of Homeland Security have shown that this is an attack on our democracy. Over the past week, President Trump has used our city as a staging ground to further his political agenda, igniting his base to cause further divisiveness, and in doing so, endangering Portlanders. Mr. President, federal agencies should never be used as your own personal army. Let's be clear, this is not political theater. This is far more dangerous than that. We have federal officers on our streets further escalating tensions and causing harm to Portlanders right now.
Garrett Graff is a journalist covering federal law enforcement. I spoke to him to break down the arguments the Trump administration is making.
Policing in the United States is uniquely complicated because the responsibilities and authorities for law enforcement are divided between local municipalities, state governments, and the federal government, each with their own area of responsibility. What is unique in Portland that is unfolding right now is the federal government sending in law enforcement personnel to a situation where state and local leaders say they don't want the help. That normally the federal government acts as a almost police of last resort, that once a situation has spiraled out of control for the local police and the state police, it's only then that federal law enforcement respond. This situation, because of the political implications and what President Trump sees as the political benefit to his reelection campaign around law and order issues in the United States right now, he has deployed a large number of federal officers against the will of the state governor and the local leadership.
You mentioned the political aspect of this, and the key thing that the mayor of Portland doesn't want these individuals there, the governor doesn't want them there. So why can't they just say, okay, you need to leave?
In essence, this is part of what makes policing so complicated, is the federal law enforcement have their own unique set of authorities. They have their own laws and their own federal crimes that they can investigate whether local leaders or state leaders want them to or not. However, in practice, that almost never happens in the United States, where you see the federal government imposing police on state leaders or local leaders without their help.
Now, as I understand it, the administration is citing the executive order to protect federal monuments, and this is why the individuals are there. But we're also seeing these police officers sent by the federal government, whether it be, you know, DHS officials from various branches, going out into the public and taking people off the streets who are protesting. How is it that they're able to do this when their mandate is so specifically targeted to only the monuments and federal property?
Yeah, so part of this issue is also that it has exposed what have been some previously largely unused and remarkably broad authorities that were laid out at the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, sort of the U.S. equivalent of an interior ministry in the early 2000s after 9/11. It's powers that the federal government technically does have, which is that they can deputize these federal officers to sort of investigate any crime that they want. But it's not something that we have really seen the U.S. Ever deploy internally, except for areas, you know, like disaster response, where there's a clear need for federal law enforcement and the federal law enforcement is requested to be part of a local state federal multi-agency team.
Garrett Graff is a journalist as well as the author of the book The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. U.S. President Donald Trump is also refusing to publicly commit to accepting the results of the upcoming White House election. AP correspondent Ben Thomas explains.
I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no, and I didn't last time either.
That's President Trump telling Fox News Sunday he won't make an ironclad guarantee that he'll accept losing.
I'm not a good loser. I don't like to lose.
Adding,
you don't know until you see. It depends. I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do.
Trump also scoffed at polls showing him lagging behind Democrat Joe Biden. The Biden campaign says the American people will decide the election, and the government is perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House. Ben Thomas, Washington.
45 hospitals in the southern U.S. state of Florida reported on Monday having no intensive care beds available, as the surge in coronavirus cases in the United States puts a strain on the healthcare system. Nationwide, the United States recorded more than 500 deaths and 63,000 new confirmed cases Sunday, and by far leads the world in the total for both categories. Globally, the total number of COVID-19 cases has reached more than 14.5 million. While the potential physical ravages of the novel coronavirus are well known, the more hidden aspects of it are the widespread anxiety, depression, PTSD, and other mental illnesses COVID-19 can cause, even among those not infected with the virus. However, in parts of Africa and the United States and elsewhere, mental illness is stigmatized, and its treatments, from the medicine to the therapy, are badly under-resourced. In the concluding part of our series about COVID-19, its effect on mental health, and what health professionals can do to help, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Yuval Nuria, a medical psychology professor at the Columbia University Medical Center and the director of the Post-Traumatic Stress Program at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Nuria also conducted research on epidemics and mental health in the United States, as well as West Africa, during the 2016 Ebola outbreak.
In the context of a virus like the coronavirus, you need somebody who will know about trauma, about fear, and for family members who unfortunately lost someone, you need an expert in bereavement and how to help people go through bereavement in a good way, in an effective way.
What do mental health professionals actually do during their sessions? What's their goal?
What mental health experts are doing, they are establishing contact with people who are struggling to talk through the experience instead of bury the experience inside because of shame or guilt or sense of failure and get the people feeling that they are not alone.
Many people do feel very alone these days, what with quarantining and social distancing and masks.
Absolutely. You know, human beings are social creatures, but COVID really separated us from our families, from our loved ones. Luckily, some of us have the internet, but you cannot touch your children via the internet. You cannot hug them. They cannot do that to you. But I would say in general that keeping the social network active in times of stress and trauma and death is so important, you know, not letting people feel deserted and abandoned. So maintain social relationships, either by phone or video or physically. We must do that.
But as a mental health expert, you found that online counseling during COVID has really been helping.
We at Columbia University Medical Center, we are coming out now with a number of solutions, and it's going pretty well. We didn't stop treatment for people who need us. We actually transitioned from face-to-face meetings, and that's worked pretty well for us.
And as you discovered during your recent trip to Kenya, more and more people on the continent are online via their smartphones. That's good for medical help as well as mental health counseling, too.
Exactly. This is so important because if we can transmit medical information about pandemic, we can also address depression and anxiety, which is always the case when you have a crisis. The first period is really about high adrenaline and how to survive. But the second and the third stages are always about grief and mental health problems that are rarely addressed. And a crisis like this provides both tangible losses. You can lose a family member, your salary, but also intangible losses. That is really about, you know, who you are as a person who loves music, loves to go out, loves to go to baseball or basketball. Something that is extreme grief about our identity kind of changing rapidly because of such a massive crisis.
Yuval Nuria is a medical psychology professor at the Columbia University Medical Center and the director of the post-traumatic stress program at the New York State Psychiatric Hospital. He was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. Now, if you missed part one of their discussion, it is available in part of Friday's show. You'll be able to find that as well as expanded coverage of the ongoing pandemic at our website. And coming up later,
the screening is conducted by the hiring agency. And when they're screened as virus-free, they are then taken into South Africa and quarantined there by the hiring agency.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, has long been touted as the scientific successor for the acclaimed Hubble Space Telescope. The JWST has a much larger mirror than Hubble and is said to be 100 times more powerful. Because of this, the new space telescope will be able to see much further into the early universe. Construction of the JWST began back in 2004, but the project has been plagued with a number of delays and cost overruns over the years. Until recently, the Webb Space Telescope was slated to launch in March 2021. NASA now says that the launch must be delayed again due to technical difficulties and impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. The scheduled launch of the JWST has now been slated for October 31st, 2021. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union summit kicked off last Friday and was supposed to wrap up on Sunday. The goal? To come up with an agreement on a $2.1 trillion EU budget and coronavirus recovery plan. But things, well, they didn't go exactly as planned. The conference spilled into Sunday and broke early Monday with no resolution. Earlier today, I spoke with journalist Catherine Field in France via WhatsApp to learn what exactly went wrong.
Essentially, it is the size of the amount of money that will be given out and whether it will be given out as a form of a grant or alone. Remember back to Friday, we were talking about the Frugal Four, those four countries that were saying that there has to be strings attached to any of these grants. It has to be strings that are attached to checking how the money is spent, making sure that there are reforms to the recovery package, making sure that there are possible reforms essentially to the economic structures in some of those countries. Well, now the Frugal Four is the Frugal Five. Finland has joined that and said, we want to make sure that any of this money that is handed out goes to countries that are respecting the rule of law. So essentially, that's what's holding it up, the nature of the conditions attached to this emergency funding. Everyone around that table, 27 heads of government, say, yes, this is urgent. Yes, the EU needs to get their economies on the right rails for the next 5 years. But what they can't agree on is how much it should be and what the strings attached to it are.
You know, I mean, we're talking shortly before they come back into session on Monday. But talks broke down over the weekend, early Monday morning, with really no end in sight. So, you know, based on what you're hearing coming out of the reporting from the summit, what kind of tax are various, you know, groups going to try to use to come to a resolution? Because, you know, this is the budget. This is the EU recovery package for the pandemic.
Indeed. Well, one of the possibilities is that they reduce the size of the package of the COVID recovery fund. So that could be reduced down from, say, at the moment, it's possible 375 billion euros. Some countries, such as Spain and Italy, say it can't go below 400 billion euros. So we might have some movement there as opposed to how much money it is. But I think you're right, Steve. A lot more has to be done to sort of smooth this over. This is the first time we've seen these EU leaders together in 5 months. And a lot of people thought perhaps once they get together again, that the personalities will be able to come to some sort of quick agreement. Honestly, it's been the opposite. At some stages in the last few days, we've seen some raw emotions, I think we could say. At one stage, you had the Austrian Chancellor accusing France and Germany of trying to put something on the table and wanting everyone else to give their approval. Another point, the French President Emmanuel Macron got very angry because the Austrian Chancellor went off to make a phone call. He said, that's it. He said, this is what I have to put up with. He's not even interested. He leaves the room when things get tough.
You already mentioned this could go into another day of discussion. How long could this conceivably go in terms of talks with the 27-member bloc before they just have to break and then start at ground zero again?
One of the big problems over the weekend was there was a lot of nervousness that the financial markets, right, respond really negatively when they opened on Monday morning to no deal having come out of these talks. But in fact, it was the European Central Bank president who came in who said, actually, it's going to be much better to have an ambitious facility rather than a quick, you know, let's get it in before the markets reopen on a Monday. So clearly what they're looking at is take your time, make an ambitious one. If need be, break up now, come back next weekend, try again, but make it something that fits, because the European Union can't be doing this again in a year's time if this agreement didn't work.
Catherine Field is a journalist living in Paris, France. The International Organization for Migration reports South Africa has lifted its COVID-19 blockade, allowing thousands of Mozambican miners to cross the border and return to work. Lisa Schlein has more.
Borders between South Africa and Mozambique have been closed since March. This has created economic hardships for the families of an estimated 28,000 Mozambican miners. They've been unable to cross the border to work in South Africa and send remittances to support their families. Spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Paul Dillon, tells VOA an agreement worked out between the two countries will allow migrants who are properly screened for the coronavirus to resume work in South Africa.
The screening is conducted by the hiring agency, and when they're screened as virus-free, they are then taken into South Africa and quarantined there by the hiring agency. for 14 days.
Dylan says the first group of 500 miners has gone through the process and received health checks at an IOM-operated cross-border occupational health center. The center was originally set up to improve the early diagnosis and treatment of tuberculosis, a condition which disproportionately affects mine workers. The IOM spokesman says another 3,000 miners will be screened at the center in the coming weeks. South Africa is the country hardest hit by COVID-19 on the continent. The World Health Organization reports more than 337,500 people are infected with the coronavirus and more than 4,800 have died. This contrasts with only 1,400 reported cases in Mozambique, including 9 deaths. Dylan says IOM has decades of experience assisting its member states with a range of health and border management issues. He says his agency hopes to use this expertise to create opportunities for Mozambicans with other skills to work in South Africa as well.
South Africa's gold and platinum mines alone employ roughly 45,000 migrant workers, and their skills are considered essential to the resumption of economic activity there. And it's hoped that thousands of migrant workers in Mozambique, including those in the agricultural sector with contracts in South Africa, will soon become part of the same process.
Dylan says IOM staff has been working with long-haul truckers at the Rosano Garcia and Machipanda border crossing since June on ways to protect themselves from COVID-19. He says they have provided nearly 7,500 truckers with prevention messages in local languages and given them practical tips for hand washing and physical distancing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In recent weeks, fighting between the Burmese army and ethnic armed groups has intensified in Burma's Rakhine State, threatening thousands of civilians. The Burmese military has been fighting the Arakan army, an ethnic armed group that has lodged a number of grievances against the central government in Rakhine and Chin states, with violence escalating significantly since January last year. A joint statement issued by the embassies of the United States, Australia, United Kingdom, and Canada stressed that access for humanitarian organizations must be allowed to provide appropriate response, particularly as communities respond to COVID-19 and the monsoon season. The joint statement called for the protection of civilians, their property, and livelihoods by all parties. The displacement of local communities along the Kiotan village tract will contribute to Rakhine's growing internally displaced population, the statement said. We're aware of reports of burning of property, shelling, and the arrests of villagers. The U.S., Australia, United Kingdom, and Canada call on all armed actors to exercise restraint while in areas inhabited by local communities, said the statement. In the meantime, the Rohingya, an ethnic and religious minority group, continue to face dire conditions in refugee and displacement camps in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, and in Rakhine State. Many have sought refuge in nearby countries, including Indonesia. The U.S. commends the government of Indonesia and local authorities in Aceh for their response to the arrival of 99 Rohingya refugees on June 24th in Indonesian waters. We applaud Indonesia's humanitarian actions with respect to this vulnerable population and for serving as a leader within ASEAN on this pressing issue, said State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas. It sets a strong example for countries in the region and the entire international community. Civilians continue to bear the brunt of the conflict in Rakhine and Chin states. Dialogue between armed actors is urgently needed. State Department spokesperson Ortega reiterated the call for a cessation to fighting, peaceful dialogue, renewed efforts to protect local communities, and access for humanitarian organizations. Furthermore, the Burmese military has obligations under the International Court of Justice to protect Rohingya and others from further harm.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.